started the first public schools with students of color, really standing up for human and civil rights. Our students are our future, so we create those learning conditions, and students' learning conditions are our working conditions, so we're always trying to make that better.
Do you find a lot of cooperation from the district?
That's debatable. Currently, the district wants transparency and collaboration, and yet they just violated part of our contract where they added minutes to the schedule, because in our contract says they're supposed to collaborate with us as a staff, not just the teachers, but the entire staff, if they're going to change the schedule. And at the beginning of the year, we were just told we were going to work, you know, extra hours, extra minutes to the day, which actually add up to 2 extra days a year. And so we filed a grievance saying we need to be working collaboratively, and we have a different interpretation of the contract and the minutes to what management is saying. So that just got filed, and we're going to be working extra days. We would also like to be paid for that.
Where do you think that's going to lead? How long of a process do you anticipate?
The district has about 10 days to respond. So, you know, if we can't come to a solution, then that could actually go to arbitration, which is where you have an arbitrator come in. It's a judge, and we choose that. And then, you know, it's binding arbitration. So whatever decision is made, it's like a courtroom. You make your case, and whatever decision that arbitrator makes is binding. I will let you know how that grievance goes.
On that note, Joe Herman, president of the California Teachers Association of Berryessa, thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
Thank you, John. Always a pleasure. Look forward to talking to you soon.
Likewise. Please make your contribution at 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles. The program that you're about to hear is a rebroadcast and has previously aired here on KPFK.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. As Professor Karen J. Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School and author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State, recently wrote, quote, "I've been covering Guantanamo since President George W. Bush and his team have responded to the 9/11 attacks by launching their disastrous global war on terror, set up that offshore prison to house people American forces had captured. For 22 years now, through 4 different administrations, that prison camp in Cuba, distinctly offshore of any conception of justice, has held individuals captured in the war on terror in a way that defies any imaginable principles of due process, human rights, or the rule of law. Of the nearly 780 prisoners kept there, only 18 were ever actually charged with a crime. And of the 8 military court convictions, 4 were overturned, while 2 remain on appeal. A large number of those captured were originally sold to the Americans for bounty or simply picked up randomly with little or no hard evidence of being terrorists. They were then, of course, denied access to lawyers. And as I was reminded recently on a trip to England where I met with a couple of released detainees, those who survived Gitmo still suffer physically and psychologically from their treatment at American hands, nor have they found justice or any remedy for the lasting harms caused by their captivity. And while the post-9/11 war on terror moment has largely faded into the past though the American military is still fighting it in distant lands, that prison camp has yet to be shut down," end quote. Professor Greenberg goes on to say, quote, "Gitmo media coverage, and so public attention, has essentially disappeared. Hardly a surprise given the current globally crushing issues of war and deprivation, injustice, and extralegal policies, not to speak of the mad discomfort of election 2024 here in America. Guantanamo, whose last inmate arrived in 2008, and whose viable path to closure has remained blocked year after year, no matter that three presidents, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and Joe Biden, each declared their desire to shut it down, persists its deviation from the law unresolved, end quote. With us today to ensure media coverage on the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not disappear from KPFK media coverage, and to discuss the ongoing atrocities being committed by the U.S. government against those still detained at Guantanamo, is our guest, Karen J. Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. She's also the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State, and Subtle Tools, The Dismantling of American Democracy from the War on Terror to Donald Trump. And she is also the co-editor of the new book, Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue. Professor Greenberg, welcome to Middle East in Focus. It's so great to have you back on the show.
Thank you so much, Nagwa, and it's very, very nice to be here.
As you know, I'm a great admirer of your work and your advocacy around the issues as it pertains to Guantanamo, because you are one of the few that make sure to not stop talking about this issue and raising awareness. So that said, I think, you know, it's sad because I feel like every time I have you on the show, I say this thing exactly. People would be surprised to learn that Guantanamo has still not been shut down, and that there are still those being detained there. Can you first start us off with an update on how many detainees are still being held at the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay? Who are they and why are they still being held there?
Yes, I can try. So of the original 780 who were at Guantanamo, there are 30 left, 10 less than when Obama took office. And they fall into several categories, and so I will talk about those categories. One is the military commission system, which is the system that was set up to try detainees, allegedly to try them. Many were charged well over a decade ago and still haven't been tried. Seven of those 11 are charged before the military commissions. Another four have been convicted, and three of them recently by plea deal. A second group are those that have been cleared for transfer by what are called periodic review boards, that the cases of detainees who have not been charged come up before, and they consider whether the detainee looks as if they pose little enough of a risk that they can be transferred to another country, and that country can be trusted to make sure they don't reengage in terrorism. So there have to be security guarantees that have to go through Congress. And there are 16 in that category. And there have been 16 in that category for quite a while now. And although they've been cleared for release, they haven't been released. And we can talk about that in a bit. And then there's the category of those who have never been charged and who have not been cleared for release. There are three in that category. So to get to your sentencing, your question, you know, why is it still open? One reason is the military commissions have completely failed to make, you know, important, significant progress over the time that they've been set up. They were set up first by the Bush administration and then in a new form by the Obama administration. But they really have made very little headway in any way. The 9/11 case the 9/11 case is still not happening. It still doesn't have a trial date. There are pretrial hearings that are going on infinitum about what kind of evidence can be introduced, particularly that which is tainted by torture, which, you know, defense attorneys argue should not be introduced. That's one of the reasons. Another reason is that it's very difficult to find countries to take the detainees. The United States since 2015 has made it against the law to bring any detainees to the United States for any reason, no matter what. And so it means, you know, in transferring them to another country, either to serve out their prison term or to be released entirely, it means, you know, in the case of those that have been convicted, it means that exquisitely detailed discussions have to go on. It was something that Obama administration did with a lot of aggression at the end of his presidency, in trying to release as many as he could before he left office. But the Biden administration has not made that kind of headway in terms of releases. So we'll, you know, see what happens on that front. So that's kind of, and as for the three that haven't been charged and won't be released, what we call forever prisoners, I don't know what the plan is or if there's a plan. So I guess it depends on what your definition of closing Guantanamo is. One would be plea deals for the military commission's cases. Those are the seven cases, all of which involve people that were accused of supporting or engaging in major terrorist attacks, including the 9/11 case. There's been a big push for plea deals in that case, taking the death penalty off the table in exchange for plea deals, with a lot of other requirements that the defendants have asked for. And the Biden administration made it known earlier that they weren't happy about the way the plea deals negotiations or ideas for the plea deals were going. So that hasn't really seen any there. So I don't know if that helps, but that's a reason. Those are the kinds of reasons that it still goes on.
Yeah, no matter how many times we talk about this issue and you clearly break it down, I still can't wrap my head around it. And I think that's a testament to what you always talk about and what we always try to talk about on this show is just how unjust all of this is. So I just have a few follow-up questions around what you just broke down. So first, talking about those who are those who are there because they've been charged by the military commission. So out of the 11, four have been convicted through plea deal, which means, again, and please correct me if I'm saying anything.
No, three through plea deal, one through a trial by a military commission.
Okay, so three through a plea deal, one through military commission. And then there's seven that have been charged, but are they still awaiting to go before the military commission or to have a trial?
So they're all in versions of what we call pretrial hearings.
Okay.
And right now it's actually kind of exciting what's going on at Guantanamo. I mean, you know, in terms of just getting stuff out in the open and debating this. They have this week, they've had one of the two psychologists that helped devise the enhanced interrogation program, the torture program for detainees that were held at black sites for years, many of them. And they had one of the psychologists on testifying. He mentioned a lot of the detainees that he had been present in the room for and been part of the brutal treatment that these detainees were given. In particular, the person accused of masterminding the 9/11 attack, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was in the room. They weren't in the same room because the psychologist testified from afar. But so it was virtual, but still that happened. And he talked about, you know, what happened in the room. And it was the real issue at the base of all of this is the judge going to allow in, what evidence is he going to allow in terms of statements made by detainees? Because after the detainees were tortured and admitted to things that they may or may not have done just to please the authorities who were brutalizing them. They were later subjected to interrogations by what we call clean teams, members of the FBI agents who did not torture them. And the theory is that this is therefore clean evidence and can be introduced, or so the prosecution holds. But many who study torture and trauma would say that, no, in fact, the trauma lasts well after the incident itself, and they've seen signs of that among the detainees, and that when they were put in a room with an FBI agent, how were they to know that the FBI wouldn't call on the CIA to come in and you know, use these torture techniques once they were there, and that you can't call this clean evidence because it still is under the shadow of having been tortured and the fear of being tortured again. And so they started this hearing. You're not going to believe this. They started this hearing, I think, in 2019. And then COVID interrupted. And so everything sort of, you know, fell apart. And now they're finally getting back to this. But it's just an example of this is torture has made it so that we really can't try these cases. We should have admitted that a long time ago and gone into a plea deal mode a very long time ago. So, yeah, we're doing it now.
And, you know, I again, it's like a whole separate show to talk about even all the violations of due process rights in terms of as it relates to how military commissions are carried out. But the one thing I did want to ask, so is there not a right to a speedy trial? So for these, you laugh, so I'll just let you go from there.
No, apparently not. There is not a right to a speedy trial. You know, the military commissions have their own law, the Military Commissions Act of 2009, which is the one passed under Obama. And speedy trial is clearly not what is going on here. And it's not just about speedy trial. It's about due process in so many different ways. What about, you know, how long can a pre-trial detention actually be? You know, and you know, the idea that we as a country do not know how to try the people that are accused of bringing about the attack of 9/11 and these other attacks as well, which include the Bali bombings and the attack on the USS Cole in 2000, all of which were lethal attacks. You know, the fact that we can't try people for this, that we don't have a system that can try them is and resolve these cases is not a sign of confidence in the American legal system, even if this is outside the American legal system, because they could have brought this also in federal court. One of the detainees was tried in federal court. One of the detainees who was tortured was tried in federal court. There are ways to do this, and we as a country have not risen to the occasion. And it's, you know, 20 years later. So whatever, 22 years later.
And so roughly these seven have been waiting for roughly about 22 years to get
different ones, different amounts of time. And, you know, a lot of them weren't arraigned until, you know, 2011, 2012, some later. So it depends on what you mean by waiting. You know, do we count their time at the CIA black sites? Probably not. Do we count when they got to Guantanamo? Probably not. So if you want to say, when did the legal process actually kick into action? Some of them have been waiting over a decade, some not that long. And so that's, you know, that's the, there's no blueprint for how this works, because it's all, so much of it is ad hoc and made up in order to just not have to deal with the real issues here. And that's what they're trying to deal with now. Can this evidence be introduced? Can the FBI, does the FBI claim that it's clean, clean evidence stand up? And there are going to be some more psychologists that testify in coming days, and we'll see what actually happens.
And like you said, there's really no blueprint, in part because it's such violations of international law, even U.S. domestic laws, just basic human rights. I want to get to the 16 that have been cleared for transfer, but related to my next question around what happened in October of 2023, which the Biden administration was supposed to be transferring 11 detainees out of the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, but halted that move. Can you talk about why that move was halted? What is the current status of these 11 individuals? And are these 11 individuals under the 16 that you laid out in the beginning that have been cleared for transfer?
Yeah. So first of all, let me say, we don't know that much about who was going to be transferred. At least I don't. Maybe someone does, but I don't know that. But here's what I will tell you about it. What we heard was that the release was imminent of these 11 and that they were going to go to Oman. At least that's what's mostly understood. I don't think there's been any official statement about this, but it was understood that they were going to go to Oman. And then October 7th happened, which sort of scrambled all of our sense of what we wanted to do in the region, how we were going to do things, how it was going to be seen in the context of geopolitics. And so that plan ended. In terms of who they were, I don't know exactly which of the 11 and 16 it was, but let me just tell you that most of the 16 that have been cleared are Yemeni. And we can't return individuals to Yemen because it's considered to be too unstable a state, too fraught with possibilities for return to terrorism, and just too difficult to maybe track individuals there and pay attention to them one way or another. So Again, it could be, you know, that's why Oman rather than Yemen. But so that's what we know. And you know, the more the Middle East disintegrates into violence and instability and the reported rise of new terrorist groups, the more reluctant authorities are going to be to release detainees anywhere near the region and the states, particularly the states that are on, you know, involved in the escalating conflict.
So I think where my confusion, though, is so those who are cleared for transfer, so the 16 that have been cleared, they've never been charged. Is that correct?
Correct.
And yet, so and so if they've, how is it like, I don't know. I mean, how is this not such a blatant violation of international laws, U.S. domestic laws? And again, I know I'm stating something that you've talked about so extensively, but just to make it clear, I mean, how is it not a violation of laws as it pertains to human rights to be keeping people who've never been charged, continuing to keep them in detention the way that they are and not releasing them?
Right. So it's a good question. And I hope I'm filling a lot of blanks here. Okay. It is kind of mind-boggling, to your point. Okay, so there's no way that I'm going to put a rational a rational patina on what you have said. However, what the United States set themselves up for this very early on by the first directive the people at Guantanamo Bay were given, the people on the ground, the American officers and others on the ground, the first directive they were given is, no matter what you do, do not call them prisoners. Because if you call them prisoners, they will be subject to international law, and they will be subject to the laws of war. They will be prisoners of war, and we cannot do this. So do not call them that, which is why they started using the term detainees, so that they were immediately taken out of known, usable, legalized, legally understood categories and put in a category all of their own. And that's what is surprising you, right? That's where the second piece of it is that they, the rationale of successive administrations in the United States has been that we're going to keep them until the war on terror is over, which is why when Biden pulled American troops out of Afghanistan, there was a sense that, wow, can we now, you know, release these prisoners and you know, call an end to the war on terror and et cetera. And, you know, part of that was what rolled out with the more were cleared for release under Obama, under Biden, and then this idea, this reported idea that they were going to be transferred to a country which we understand to be Oman. So the real answer to your question is, it's not fair. It was never fair. It didn't follow international military or domestic law as it stood prior to 9/11. But the law was messed with after 9/11, and the standards were messed with after 9/11. And interestingly enough, to your question, for the first time ever, the Biden administration allowed into Guantanamo Bay the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and Counterterrorism, this amazing woman by the name of Fionnuala Ni'alim. And she wrote a report on Guantanamo, and she really had access to everybody she wanted, the families, et cetera, people at Guantanamo, et cetera, officials. And she wrote this magnificent report on the violations at Guantanamo. And she focused on things you might not have expected. For example, she focused on the victims' families and how unfair this is to the victims' families and the victims of 9/11, that they haven't tried the perpetrators in court. And just talked about the devastation of that and what it means, because as we understand, trials are supposed to be a healing process that gives some kind of closure by presenting facts. So she focused on that. She focused on the treatment of the detainees themselves, the conditions they've been held under, although they've improved since some of the earlier times, it doesn't matter because their access to their families in terms of communications are still truncated. Their health problems are massive, particularly for those who were tortured. Even those who are on trial in the 9/11 trial, one was just found psychologically incapable of standing trial. Another one can barely sit down because of how he was raped during his torture. I mean, it goes on and on. And then the third category she talks about, and I think this is really very valuable, is those who have been released, the conditions under which they live in the countries they've been released to are often horrific. They can't get jobs because they're considered too, you know, they can't get jobs. They have no way to make money. They can't participate in society the way they need to. And she sees this also as a violation that needs to be attended to. So just to your point, there are some people paying attention, but, you know, how to get from here to there, even though it's 30 individuals, it still seems to be too high a hurdle to accomplish.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking today about making sure that we at KPFK are including in our media coverage the issues surrounding the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay and discussing the ongoing atrocities being committed by the U.S. government against those 30 who are still detained at Guantanamo with our guest Karen J. Greenberg, the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. She's also the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State, and Subtle Tools, The Dismantling of American Democracy from the War on Terror to Donald Trump. And she is co-editor of the new book, Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue. Professor Greenberg, I say this every time. I could talk to you forever. I have one last question, though, because we do have to start wrapping up.
Of course.
So now what we've talked about is, essentially, there, you know, when we're talking about these, so there's 16 that have never been charged and cleared for release. There's an additional, I believe it's 3 that have never been charged but not cleared for release. So they are forever prisoners. I think you brought up the point that the government wants to use the term detainees rather than prisoners to get around what is their legal obligation in terms of human rights, due process,
Well, that's what they did at the beginning. That's how they set it up, and that's kind of what we're living with now. But that was intentional in the beginning, yeah.
Yeah, and so I will actually make sure to be calling them what they are, which is prisoners. All that said, my last question, the detention facility at Guantanamo and the global war on terror are good examples of how governmental claims of, quote, protecting national security has been used to justify injustice, violence, and atrocious violations of human rights. Can you elaborate on this idea about how these types of policies, Gitmo, the global war on terror, and as your new book talks about, the lack of integrity in elections actually endangers peace, security, and stability for the United States and actually for the entire world?
I'm not sure I can draw a straight line from Guantanamo to election security, but I can draw a straight line from the willingness to violate longstanding norms, laws, and policies, which is endemic to how we fought the war on terror, and the resultant sort of waning of trust in the power of U.S. institutions that I think resulted from that we see sort of some instances of that and sort of consequences of that in the way in which this election season has focused on the fragility of our institutions. Can you trust our courts? No. Can you trust our Congress? No. Can you trust our executive, the administration, cabinet members, etc.? Not necessarily. There's been a sense of kind of paralysis and in some ways kind of helplessness. And so the real thing about this election cycle is, can it overcome these sort of distrust and doubts about our institutions themselves by being an election that seems safe and secure and viable, and that we know what we're doing? And so I don't think there's a direct connection, but I think that there is an atmospheric connection. And I do think that once you decide to start breaking things apart, you never know where it's going to go. And I think that's part of what we're living with.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we have been talking today to ensure media coverage on the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not disappear from KPFK media coverage, and have been discussing the ongoing atrocities being committed by the U.S. government against those still detained at Guantanamo with our guest, Karen J. Greenberg, director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. She's also the author of The Least Worst Place, Guantanamo's First 100 Days, Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security state, and subtle tools, the dismantling of American democracy from the war on terror to Donald Trump. And she is the co-editor of the new book, Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue. Thank you, Professor Greenberg, for joining us once again on Middle Eastern Focus. And we thank you so much, all the listeners, for joining us today. I want to thank our fantastic engineer, Gary Baca. Please remember you.